Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and other musicians, uncover their life stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, then stick around. You're in the right place. If you, like the rest of America, are looking to move down here to the Tampa Bay area in Florida and you want to work with a realtor who knows the area well, then make sure you reach out to Ann at West Florida Real Estate. Ann has sold over 350 homes here in the Bay Area over the last 6 years. She's smart, she's lived in the area for 16 years, and you won't find anyone around with a better work ethic. Reach out to her at Ann with an E at westfloridarealestate.com and let her know you heard about her here on Everyone Loves Guitar. That's Ann with an E at westfloridarealestate.com. For information on advertising, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. And if you're enjoying the show and you'd like to support it, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. And I have a really special guest with us today with Danny Korchmar, great LA session and touring player. I'll give you his background in a minute. One is quick thank you to Lisa Roy for hooking us up. Lisa, thanks very much. All right. This is going to be like a very abbreviated bio because Danny's done so many things. I would need an hour just to go through his bio. So he's originally from New York City. He's most well known, as I mentioned, for being a successful LA touring and session guitarist. And he's also co-written a number of big hits. He's one of the session players every baby boomer, including myself, saw on the back of hundreds of albums starting in the 70s. Some of the people Danny's played, toured, or produced include James Taylor, Linda Ronstadt, Jackson Browne, Warren Zevon, Rod Stewart, Carole King, David Crosby and Graham Nash, Stephen Stills, John Kay, Etta James, Bill Wyman, Harry Nilsson, David Cassidy, Keith Moon, Sam and Dave, Ringo Starr, Eric Carmen, the Pointer Sisters, Bonnie Raitt, Steve Cropper, Don Henley, Glenn Frey, Bob Seger, Neil Young, Henry Mancini, Bob Dylan, Bon Jovi, Hall & Oates, The Monkees, The Beach Boys, Toto, Robin Ford, who was on here a little while ago, Herbie Hancock, Nina Simone, Buddy Guy, and hundreds of others. He's co-written songs with Jackson Browne and James Taylor. He wrote Don Henley's hit, All She Wants to Do Is Dance, from the Building the Perfect Beast album. Excuse me, as well as New York Minute from Don Henley's End of the Innocence album, as well as a number of other co-writes on both of those records. And even though he swears he's never smoked weed, he did produce and co-write a number of tracks on the Cheech and Chong movie Up in Smoke. Danny's been in a number of his own bands over the years. Again, I'd have to go on a long list, but his current project is called The Immediate Family. It's a three guitar band with Danny, Waddy Wachtel, and Steve Postel on guitar, Leland Sklar on bass, and Russ Kunkel on drums. They have a new record coming out. It's a self-titled album called The Immediate Family. Man, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate you coming on.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome, man. I forgot. I wonder if I asked you about Nina Simone. Before we get started, I just want to ask you about Nina Simone because...
All right. You know, with that one, I got to tell you, I've never played with Nina Simone. I don't know how that got on that list.
Wikipedia.
Wikipedia is wrong a lot, you know.
Yeah, anytime there's no barrier to entry, you're going to have a lot of mistakes. Thank you for clearing that up. Mm-hmm. All right. You grew up in New York City. You started playing there in clubs. How did you initially get interested in playing music? Like, was your family musical or...
Well, actually, my family was musical on my mother's side, but they were classical musicians. They were all from they're from Soviet Union. They're from Russia, and they were brilliant, brilliant musicians. Her father and his two brothers all played in the NBC Philharmonic under Toscanini. So that's some badass shit.
Holy shit, man!
Yeah, but on the other hand, I mean, I'm a total primitive. You know, they were sophisticated classical musicians, who I'm not even in the same world with them. But I am a musician, so.
But they were supportive, though, of you playing music, I'm sure, right?
Well, my family, my mother was pretty supportive as much as she could be. My father, on the other hand, was not. And he thought he was going to be supporting me the rest of my life, you know, the rest of his life, you know.
Yeah.
He was shocked when I ended up not asking him for money all the time. So.
Oh, that's cool. What did your dad do? What kind of work did he do?
He owned and ran a small factory in the Bronx that made screw machine parts for the government and for other manufacturers.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, that was, man, there's no more businesses like that anywhere in New York City.
There aren't. That's right.
Back in the day. What was the music scene like in the city at that time in the mid 60s?
Oh, you know, it was, for me, it was absolute paradise. New York City was an absolute, I mean, Disneyland for adults, as far as I was concerned. And if you look at any of the flyers or any of the pages, entertainment pages from that period, you can see an incredible panoply of musicians and performers in every area of endeavor. And it was really amazing, an incredible environment. Me and my buddies used to go down to Greenwich Village and cruise New York pretty much every weekend.
Right.
And I saw the original John Coltrane Quartet. I just walked in. We just walked into the club like it was nothing.
What club was that?
It was, I think, the Five Spot or the Half Dome, one of those clubs.
Wow.
And, you know, that's what else. We saw Sun Ra. We saw, you know, Dave Van Ronk. We saw Lightning Hopkins, Muddy Waters, Latin music, which was exploding then, Eddie Palmieri's orchestra and all this different music. We also used to go to the Apollo every week we could. Every Friday, there was a new show at the Apollo, and we'd go up there and see all the incredible, great soul and R&B acts there, which was just for me, just absolute paradise.
Yeah, that's so cool. Do you know Carlos Alomar?
I may have met Carlos at some point. I, of course, not. I know who he is, but
yeah, he was in the house band at the Apollo. How crazy is that?
Lots of great musicians that were in that house band, absolutely, and they sounded great.
What made you move to California? Like, when did you move, and what prompted that move?
Well, there's a couple of things. One was I was started freezing my ass off in New York. One time, I was walking down 57th Street or something like that. It's snowing. There's sleet everywhere. I'm carrying an amp in one hand and a guitar in the other hand. And I said, later for this. This has got to be something better. And this is, at the time, there wasn't a big, well, there probably was a session scene, but I wasn't in it.
Right.
I was playing on Carole King, Carole and Jerry's demos, Goffin and King demos. I met Carole. She was bringing me in to work on her demos for her publishing company. And I learned a tremendous amount from playing on that. That was my original experience doing sessions, and working with Carole King is like going to Harvard. I mean, like she knows everything. She's a genius, not just at songwriting, but also at production and arrangement, and brilliant, brilliant woman. So I learned a tremendous amount from her, but like I said, I was freezing my ass off and I'd heard about, I was playing with the Fugs at the time. I don't know if anyone out there knows about the Fugs, but
right. They
were kind of East Village poets that decided, like everyone else did, to start a rock and roll band. Cause that's where, you know, pardon my French, but if you want to get any pussy, you need to be in a rock and roll band. I didn't offend anyone.
It's a real New Yorker right here, man.
So everyone was starting rock and roll bands, and me and my buddies were back them up at a theater. I was getting tired of that because I wasn't really a musical entity as much as a performance kind of thing. So there was a band called Clear Light that had come into town from L.A., and I knew some of them. And I'd heard that they were auditioning for a guitar player. They needed a new guitar player. So I went down there and auditioned and got the gig. And, you know, out we went. I said, what the hell? I'm not going anywhere here. Let me go to L.A. Wow. So I went out there. And I remember the pay was 70 bucks a month. And I think it was 30 bucks a week. All told, you know, all in. That was what we were getting paid.
Wow.
But back then you could live real cheap, you know, and
yeah.
I had already had made a few bucks from New York. So I was okay. So that's how I got out there.
Was there like culture shock when you got out? You went straight to LA, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Was there culture shock?
Oh, you bet. Absolutely.
What was it? Tell me about that.
Absolutely. Well, a lot of different things. One was just the weather and the environment, but people lived in houses in Los Angeles. You could drive up the hill to Laurel Canyon. There's all these houses. That was, to me, unbelievable, because obviously in Manhattan, and no houses, you know, you live in apartments. Everyone did. So that was one difference. Another difference is the musician. I immediately met tons of musicians because I lived in Laurel Canyon when I first moved out there. And everyone was hanging out with everybody else. It was a much more open scene, a friendlier scene than in New York. New York was unfriendly.
You
know?
Yeah.
And, you know, especially in the session world, it was a very closed environment. In New York City, at that time, especially, if you wanted to make money as a musician, you had to be work for a pit band for one of the Broadway shows, or do jingles, or if you're lucky, be a musician on one of the TV shows, like the Johnny Carson show. So, and that was the way you can make money. In LA, everyone was starting rock and roll bands. That's how you did your things. So it was a much more open scene. Everyone was friendlier. And like I said, I kind of fell right in with some terrific people.
That's awesome, man. How did you, once you get there, how did you go about getting work and like establishing yourself?
Well, shortly after I moved there, several things happened. One was that Carol moved out there.
Oh, okay.
Moved out to LA. That was one thing. Another thing that happened was Peter Escher started coming out a lot. I was old friends with Peter from New York, and he was coming out there a lot to talk to Warner Brothers about getting a deal for James Taylor. So this all happened at the same time. So here comes Carol. She signs to Lou Adler's label. James signs to Warner Brothers. And Carol calls me to play on her first. The first album she made was called, it was under the rubric of The City. She didn't want to be a solo performer. She was nervous about being a solo performer. So that was the first real experience I had making a full album. With, you can imagine, the first shot is with Carole King and Lou Adler.
Yeah, that's good. A pretty good deal, man.
Damn straight, yeah. And then I learned again, Lou Adler, genius level producer, a wonderful guy, you know, just the coolest cat ever, you know. And I learned a tremendous amount from him. So that was how it got started. Then Peter got James a deal. So now I'm playing on Tapestry and I'm playing on Sweet Baby James. And a big difference was, I want to point this out, Peter Escher put our names and Lou put our names on the back of the covers. Now, the session musicians previous to that, the generation before us, was called the Wrecking Crew. You probably right. know. Their names didn't appear on those records right. that they played on. They played for everybody, but their names didn't appear on the records. Ours was a different thing. It was the start of the so-called singer-songwriter movement, and our names appeared on those records. So when that caught on and people started signing, you know, artists that wrote their own songs and performed their own songs, they could see our names associated with these brilliant people. So that was made a tremendous difference and enabled us to get called for sessions and do work.
Well, and those playing with James and Carole King, my God, that's incredible freaking exposure.
Well, yeah, it was because those records took off and became huge, as you know. Yeah. And, it was a tremendous boost for all of us. We were at the right place at the right time.
Where did that lead you as far as other work?
Well, I'll tell you what, it meant that people that were making records like that, and everyone was now trying to jump on the singer-songwriter. Again, it wasn't called that at the time, but that's kind of what it ended up being called.
What was it called? Soft rock, like what was it called? Rock?
It had no name. You know, believe me, all those nomenclatures, that's created by the rock critics and writers. Musicians don't call themselves that. Musicians don't, describe themselves in those terms.
Right, right.
So that was the term invented by journalists.
Right.
You know, right. Certainly not by the people that were doing it. But sure. Anyway, more and more records were being made that way. And that also was spared down. Remember, instead of being cluttered with tons of horns and strings and background vocals, those records, Tapestry and Sweet Baby James, were spare. And that's one of the reasons that they caught on with people. Their intimacy of them, I think, attracted people.
Yeah, man. That, you know what? That word, that's a really good word to use to describe like the difference between some of the music back then and some of the music you hear in now. It's not as intimate. I think that's a very good word. Mm-hmm. I'm going to talk about some of the artists you work with. If you could talk about how you wound up first connecting with them and then maybe a cool or interesting story about working with them. You talked about James. So let's start with him. Maybe a cool or interesting story about working with him.
Oh, well, James and I were childhood buddies, you know.
I read that, yeah.
And, you know, we met, I think he was 13, or, you know, we were both around 13 or 14 when I met him. And he wasn't even playing guitar then. We were hanging out together. All right, so the first time I realized what he was all about was we were hitchhiking somewhere. We were both on Martha's Vineyard Island.
Okay.
Now, back then, Martha's Vineyard was a bucolic little scene. It was not like the Hamptons like now. It wasn't the, this only for zillionaires. It was a very kind of, you know, middle class. Everyone was quiet about it. And then there were no zillionaires up there. And if they were, they kept quiet about it. Now, of course, you know, it's just like, you know, every place else where there's zillionaires.
Yeah. Like the Hamptons is a good analogy.
Yeah, but then it was, like I said, bucolic, quiet, you know, pastoral almost. And James and I used to hitchhike all over the island. That's how all us pals, all of us got around. So one time we're walking down the street and hitchhiking, and he starts to sing. And he starts to sing Ray Charles' Hallelujah, I Love Her So. And he goes into, let me tell you about the girl. I said, this guy can sing. I knew what good singing was by then because I had already been, I was already a big, huge music fan and really into it. So when he went into that, I went, this guy can sing, and he can sing really well. I couldn't believe it. I never met anyone that, I didn't know anyone that could really sing, you know?
Right.
So we started hanging out more and more. He and I became and still are very, very close friends, and I love him very much. And we started playing music together, and he picked up the guitar. He learned how to play his basic style basically in a year.
You know? Wow.
He went back home from Martha's Vineyard. When he came back the next year, he basically had his style that you hear now, the essence of it. You know, took him a year to figure it out. Bang.
That's pretty cool. That's
what happens when you're young. When you're young, you don't know that it's hard. You don't know that it's impossible. You just go, oh yeah, here we go.
And you got no commitments, and you could spend all day long doing stuff like that. Yeah.
So we love the same kind of music. We love soul music, and but the folk music was also happening at the time. And we liked that, especially for me. It brought back folk music, reintroduced people to all the great blues musicians, like my favorite Lightnin' Hopkins. And I learned a lot. I imitated Lightnin' to the degree that a nice little Jew boy like me can do that. So it was, a growth period for both of us, for sure.
That's cool, man. Linda Ronstadt, you've done a lot of work with her. How did you guys first connect, and a cool story?
Well, everybody knew everybody back then. And, I knew Linda, but all of us knew each other. You know, it was a big family at the time. And I had stopped touring with James and was hanging around. And Peter Escher called me and said that, would I be interested in touring with Linda Ronstadt? I said, absolutely, of course. So they sent me a cassette of the desk mix, the front of house mix, for me to learn her show. So I sat in my car. Every time I go in my car, I listen to it and kind of pick up on it, and I play along with it at home. And then I go to the first rehearsal. I get up there and we tune up, we start to play. Linda comes out. Linda's an absolute dog, wonderful person. Very sharp, very astute, very funny, and just a terrific individual. So we went into the first tune. It's so easy, Buddy Holly's It's So Easy. As soon as she hit it, it was like a knife going through my head. I had never been on stage with anyone that had that much power. Remember, James was kind of low key.
Very much.
James was a fantastic vocalist, but she had such stunning power. It just was the loudest thing I ever heard in my life and the most intense vocal I'd ever heard. And I said, this is going to be good. And it was. I loved touring with Linda. The band was great. It was just a great experience.
That's cool. Steven Stills, man, talk about a great guitar player. What'd you do with him?
He was one of the first people I met when I moved to LA, the Laurel Canyon. And he was very friendly to me. Those guys were so nice. Him and Crosby were two of the first people I met in LA. And they were as sweet as you could imagine. Very, very generous and kind and terrific. And I'll always be indebted to both them cats for how lovely they were to me and how much encouragement they gave me. And I already was terribly impressed. I thought Buffalo Springfield were just the bomb. And they were incredibly great, as we all did. So I got to hang out with him a little bit. And, he was one of my heroes. And to a large degree still is. Absolutely great.
Yeah.
Fantastic player, fantastic songwriter.
And great song. His solo records are just awesome.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's a monster, for sure.
Etta James, did you work with her?
Well, I played on an album, an Etta James album. Trevor Lawrence was producing. Trevor, the sax player and producer from New York. And he put a bunch of us together to make an album. Etta James wasn't there for any of the sessions. I got to tell you. But it was a great band. I think, Spiderweb was the drummer. Who's the bass player? I can't remember. Stevie Wonder's bass player, fantastic. I'll think of his name in a minute. My buddy William Smith, Smitty, who's a B3 player, great cat. And all this, we sat down there and just read charts. Trevor had written out charts for the whole thing. We went bang, 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 tune after tune. And Etta never showed up. I never saw her.
Oh, that's such a shame.
So that was my Etta James experience.
Now, I know you're going to have some stories with this guy because I've had a lot of people on to play with him, Harry Nilsson.
Oh, what a great cat, man. What a lovely, lovely man. I loved him. He was one of the smartest people I ever met. Absolutely. Incredibly bright, well-read, educated, articulate guy. Wonderful, wonderful guy. And obviously a stunning talent musically. And I loved hanging out with him. It was enjoyed every minute I was with him. And I learned a tremendous amount from him because he, like I said, very, very bright guy.
I thought he was a New York guy, though.
Yeah.
So you, did you play? You play with him in when you were in the city, or they were you in L.A. at that time?
No, so I was in L.A. The way I got to meet him, I played on an album called Pussycats, and Pussycats was John Lennon and Harry Nilsson.
Right.
I got on that date because I was very good friends with Jim Keltner. Mm-hmm. Jim Keltner plays a huge role in my life. He was, I would call him my rabbi. He turned me on and introduced me to so many people and got me on so many situations. And Jimmy was so beloved by everybody, the Stones, the Beatles, I mean, everyone, and deservedly so. He was a wonderful person, a great musician. So all he had to do is I'd walk into a session or someplace with him and he'd say, "Oh, this is Cooch, my guitar player." That's all I had to say. I was accepted just because I knew him. If I'm his guitar player, I must be good. I must be fine. And sure enough, I ended up working on this record with John Lennon and Harry Nilsson. And it was a really fun experience.
What was it like interacting with those two guys? How did they interact with each other?
Well, you know, they loved each other. They were, you know, laughing and joking all the time. But they also were serious about the music. Yeah. This is during the time of the so-called Lost Weekend, the Harry Nilsson and John Lost Weekend. But I must tell you that I was with them for 2 or 3 weeks every day doing that album. Never saw anything. Any misbehavior. They never pulled rank, either of them. John Lennon never pulled rank, never acted like a star, was the most approachable guy, lovely, lovely man, and wow. Totally approachable, and never behaved in any weird way ever. I mean, we were all, you know, to be honest with you, we were all high. And we were
of course.
Yeah. But no one acted like an asshole ever that I saw. So whatever happened that night, I don't know. I wasn't there, but the rest of the time when we were working, everyone was great and having a ball.
You know, it's funny. I've had I think it was Bob Glaub. Keltner played a huge role in his career as well. So he must be just that kind of guy.
Yeah, Jimmy Lee Keltner has been a source of joy for a lot of musicians. He has brought a lot of people into the fold because, like I said, he is so highly respected and so beloved by everyone that once you show up with him, once he says you're okay, you're okay. And so he's helped a tremendous amount of musicians, lots and lots of musicians.
Another like huge star you work with, Neil Young.
Mm-hmm. Neil.
Yeah.
Well, Neil's a great cat also. Again, like I said, everybody knew everybody back in the day in L.A., you know, and we all hang out together. The first time I got to play with him was on a Monkees session.
Okay.
And some music for their movie Head. They made a full length feature.
I remember that movie. Yeah, it was
kind of stupid.
Yeah.
Anyway, the soundtrack. Carol and Jerry had written a song called "As We Go Along." I hope I'm remembering this correctly. I think that's right. And I can't remember who the whole band was, but the guitar section was Neil, Ryan Cooter, and myself.
Holy shit!
Yeah, that's what I thought too. And we all did our thing. Neil did his beautiful thing with, he had turned tremolo on and played his part. Rye, of course, did his slide stuff. And I don't remember what I did, but it was pretty
wow. Good. You, Rye Cooter, and Neil Young.
Yeah.
On a Monkees session. Go figure.
That's it. Yeah.
All right. This one is, so Keith Moon, you did that solo record. That record is touted as one of the worst records ever made. And he only played drums on one track, which is even weird. You got to have some good stories in that one.
I got to tell you, I don't remember much about that. And I would say that anybody involved in that session doesn't remember much about it. But I would say this is that Keith Moon, again, lovely guy, really a sweet guy. All the stories about him breaking up stuff, they're probably true. And he did have a kind of wild look in his eye, but he was very friendly. Very open. Again, never pulled rank. Those English cats, they don't walk around telling everybody how great they are and acting like big shots, you know? I got to tell you that, you know, the A&R guys that worked for record companies in the 70s and 80s had much, much bigger egos than anyone in the Rolling Stones or the Beatles.
Yeah. Interesting. You got to wonder why. Why?
Insecurity.
Yeah.
Like, Keith Richards is not insecure.
Right. No, it's a great point, man, because like, what does ego do for you? You know, here today, gone tomorrow, man, you know,
dig it.
So tell me what, from your perspective, top three session experiences you've had and what made them so, you know, what's the nostalgia in that for you?
Oh, man, I don't know.
Tough question, I know. Knee jerk.
Well, that's a real tough one. I loved playing with Crosby and Nash and recording with them. They brought us in, Russ Kunkel, myself, Tim Drummond on bass, and I played guitar, and it was just the ball. As soon as they walk in, they said, "Let's hit. Come on, here we go." It was like the engineers had to rush around to get them going because they wanted to hit immediately. And I remember Nash would say things like, "All right, guys, let's make history." I loved that because that means he's taking it serious. You know, he means it. And I want to work with people that mean it from top to bottom. And those guys were like that. We all dug deep playing with those guys because it was, you know, we felt like I said, it's not like we're making history, like, oh, look at us big shots. It was, let's do something great.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was one memorable thing. All the stuff I did with Don Henley in the studio was great. He and I had a wonderful time in there creating, coming up with stuff. So all those sessions were terrific. I don't know, man. I've been involved with so many.
I know.
James Taylor, all those albums were tremendous. That was Russ and Lee and myself on pretty much all of them. And being able to play these great songs. You walk in, James plays you a song. It's like, wow. You sit down and you got to come up with something to accent, to accompany and to, you know, to help that song right now. And so that really got you going. I must tell you that I became and still am a terrible snob when it comes to songs because of having worked with these brilliant songwriters, with James and Jackson and Henley, you know.
And Carol King.
Carol, you know, forget it, man. It's unbelievable. So, like I said, I'm very spoiled from having been able to work on all this great music.
Yeah, I'm sure. How could you not be?
Yeah, well, right.
How about touring experience, top three?
Running on Empty. How about that one? You know, Jackson put us all together and here he is. We're going to go out. We're going to make a live album of all new material that the audience never heard before, you know, on the road. And we're going to record it. And we're also going to record in hotel rooms. We're going to record on the bus. We're going to record in backstage. And we did. That's what happened. Jackson, very ambitious. But once he, you know, once he gets his mind set on something, that's it. He's just going to go all the way. He doesn't do stuff half-assed and he doesn't do things halfway. So we plunged right in and we learned his new material. It's funny because as soon as we went out and played Running on Empty, the first time we played it, remember, nobody had ever heard it. Right. The audience reacted like they'd been on the radio for a year. I mean, they reacted like they knew it. And but it was an incredible risk. What if they didn't? What if they didn't like it? He's recording this. This is a new album. So if it didn't go over, that's what we would have been stuck with. But they responded beautifully.
Goes back to what you said. Great songwriting, man.
That's right. Yes,
it's just a great song.
Exactly right.
What top three record touring? So Jackson.
Well, that, you know, I'd have to mention the Troubadour reunion tour that we did 10 years ago with James and Carol. James and Carol, Russ Lee and myself on that, you know, together again. And Russ and I couldn't believe it that this was going to actually happen, but it did. And it was an incredible experience. We'd gotten together for the first time. All of us hadn't been together in many, many years. And we went, during rehearsal, we went right into it. It was like that no time had gone by. And we just fell right in and it was like we had been playing all that time. So that was an incredible love experience for sure.
Yeah, that's nice. One more you want to say?
Let me see. I don't know. I'm trying to think.
It's hard. Well, it's like asking your favorite kid, man.
Right. Well, any of Linda Ronstadt's tours. Mm-hmm. Great band, terrific band. Andrew Gold, Kenny Edwards, Russ on drums, Bob Glaub on bass. Fantastic band. And I loved every minute of it because the set list, I've been used to just playing James Taylor songs, you know, or whoever artist I was out with. With Linda, she was doing an Elvis Costello song, a George Jones song, a Jim Webb song, a Buddy Holly song, a Chuck Berry song, and then back around, you know. So we played all this different material. And of course, Linda had an unfailing sense of what, you know, a great, great taste in what material she chose for herself. So every song was different and every song was by some genius level writer. So that really, you know, while I'm playing the song, I'm just looking forward to playing the next song because I know it's going to be great. So that was a lot of great experience.
Not to put you on the spot, but what do you think you brought to the table that was different? That, like, I mean, there's a reason why you got all these calls beyond that you knew how to play pretty good.
Well, I'll tell you what, we had to, Russ Lee and myself and all the cats from that period, we were brought in to be ourselves. In other words, we weren't brought in to be somebody else. We were brought in to play, to create our own parts. So they play a song, we're supposed to create a part. We were given basically lead sheets with just the chords. Mm-hmm. And come up with something now, you know? And so that was intriguing. But after you do it, you get real good at it. You get to be able to come up with parts that are going to help the song and that are going to make the artist smile.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. You got to be able to make people happy. And that's the entire program when you go into playing music. You got to make the drummer happy and the producer and the singer. And, you know, all of us wanted to make each other happy and come up with something wonderful. So attitude had a lot to do with it. You had to have a terrific attitude, an attitude of wanting to be great, wanting to do stuff right, and loving it, and being respectful and loving to your fellow musicians.
So it's clear to me that, like, being excellent is super important to you. Where did that work ethic come from?
God, I don't know. I didn't see it as work. I loved every minute of it, you know. I didn't see it as a job. I still don't. I don't see it as a career or a job. I see it as a way of life, almost like a religion, a way of being. And so I don't see it as work, you know.
Tell me a couple of things that you might have done at the time that were out of your comfort zone, but they turn out to be really good things that you did.
I don't know. I'm not sure how to answer that one. Out of my comfort zone. Most of the time when I was doing, most of the stuff I worked on was in my comfort zone. That's why I was there. There was one time I got called. I wondered if I could do a jingle. And John Guerin, the great John Guerin, the drummer, said, "All right, come in and do this jingle." So I sat down, looked at the chart, and I went, "Nope, I don't have a chance." You know, now the guys, you know, the guys like Tommy Tedesco and Dean Parks, they could look at that chart and read it, bang, like that. You know, but for me, I hadn't read music in a long time. I was a pretty good sight reader when I was in high school. Sure. But I had lost the ability because I never had to read anything. I was always called upon to create my own parts.
Right.
So I was really blessed. Talk about flop sweat. I was so embarrassed because it was way above my pay grade.
Sure.
Reading these charts. And everyone else is just going, wham, you know.
Yeah. So, where'd you go to high school?
I went to high school in Westchester County, about 20 minutes outside of Manhattan. That's where I grew up. I was born in New York, but then my family moved to Westchester.
Tell me two or three best concerts you've seen. Cause I can't imagine. Yeah. I can't imagine some of the shows you already told me. That's nuts.
All right. Well, James Brown at the Apollo.
Holy shit.
That would be one. Otis Redding at the Apollo would be another one. Peter Gabriel, and he did when he came through LA and played the Forum. Fantastic. I was in tears. It was so brilliant. He opened with Red Rains. Greatest thing I ever saw in my life. Just unbelievable. Just heart stopping. So I'd have to mention that.
Yeah, he's amazing.
So that's three, right?
Yeah. I actually have his producer coming on here in September. Dave Bottrell, I think his name is. He's just amazing. Guitar wise, I know you're a big Tele guy. Tell me what your go-to guitar is now and like what other two guitars would round out your top three.
Well, like most people, you know, you trade guitars a lot and try stuff out. Tele is my main guitar, yes. I also have a very nice G&L, the G&L Doheny guitar that they made for me that I like a lot. It's terrific. It's kind of like a Jazzmaster. But I always end up going back to my Telecasters. I got three or four of them. I started with Tele and I kind of...
You've always been a Tele guy pretty much then.
More or less, yeah.
Interesting. What's the last thing you listened to music-wise?
The last thing I listened to? Yeah. Let's see.
pull out your iPhone or something.
All right. Well, the last thing I wanted to turn my girlfriend on to a James Brown track called Can't Stand Myself When You Touch Me. It's a kind of obscure James Brown track.
Yeah, I've never heard that one.
It's so low down. It is so badass. That groove is just unstoppable. And James wailing away on top of it. I would say you want to hear that.
Yeah, I'm writing it down in red. What's your top three Desert Island discs? That'd be interesting to hear.
Oh, let me see. I don't know. Off the top
just for
of
this,
head.
Just for this minute. Just for this minute.
I don't know. Muddy Waters Greatest Hits, Revolver by the Beatles, Miles Davis In a Silent Way. That's three.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's a long list now.
Oh, hell yeah.
I hope it's a big desert island.
Hey, so let's talk about the new Immediate Family record. First of all, what prompted you guys to get together in the first place? I know you, Kunkel, and Leland, as you've mentioned, have played with each other countlessly. What made you all finally come together and do a record?
Well, I've been offered, sorry, I keep clearing my throat. I've been offered a deal by a Japanese label. And they went to a friend of mine named Fred Mullen and said, would Danny Korchmar be interested in making a solo album for Japanese, for Asian release? So I said, yeah, sure, great. And I started thinking, well, how should I do this? Who should I get to play on it? Because I know a lot of great musicians, as you know, and they're my dear friends. And I thought, you know, let me just see. Russ and Lee are probably gone because they're always out touring. And I mean,
right.
Those guys are two of the most in-demand musicians in the world. But amazingly, they were in L.A. And I guess because, you know, because we're such old friends, they agreed to come down and play. We did that album in 3 days. Waddy was on the road with Stevie at the time. And he came in the last day, fortunately. So now here we are, you know, the four of us. I've been working with a fellow named Steve Postel. Steve lives around the corner from me. He's a very fine guitarist and singer. And he helped me with the pre-production and the post-production of that album.
Right.
So he was there, too. And as we played and started running this stuff, I went, this is great. I mean, look at this. Then I got offered a gig in Japan to go over and play a couple of club dates there. So naturally, I said, at this point, I want it to be a band. I wanted it to be a band right away.
Right.
I always wanted to be in a band. I always have been in bands, even when I was doing other stuff.
Sure.
So the boys, we had so much fun. Amazingly, everyone fell in and wanted to be part of it as well. And it grew from there. We did that first little club tour in Japan. It solidified us. And we just kept going from there. That's, you know, it's a love thing with all of us. Like I said, we're family. I've been playing with him for 45 years, and he's one of my dearest friends, and they all are. They're all my best friends. So it was just a natural evolution.
Fred Mullen, half the time in Nashville, half the time in L.A.?
Fred is mostly Nashville.
Yeah, man. I had him on here a little while back. It's funny you said that. How is it different playing your own music as opposed to like working in sessions together?
Well, you know, it's completely different. When you're playing your own music, it's you. There's no place to hide. You're not backing someone else up. You're not thinking about what someone else would like. You have to come up with the stuff yourself in terms of what it's going to be good for when there is no leader, there is no boss, and there is nobody paying you. You're paying yourself. You're doing it for yourself.
Right.
So it requires brotherhood. It requires everybody being on the same page. And wanting the same results.
Well, I want to talk about a couple of tracks. Divorced. Most people write songs about divorce that are like sad and acrimonious, but this song was more like a rock song with kind of like lighthearted lyrics and a really good groove. So
I don't know if the lyrics are lighthearted. They're sarcastic. That's sure.
Right. But they're not like, you know, crying in your beer kind of stuff, you know?
No, I don't really do crying in your beer too much.
What prompted you guys to write that song? I'm assuming a prior experience of divorce or.
Well, it's funny. I was stuck on the 405 in L.A. and I was going, I'm dying on this. So I went home a few hours later and ended up writing the lyrics. Now, usually I write the music first. Generally, for instance, when I was working with Henley, I would create tracks and make demos of stuff at home, just the music.
Right.
And if he liked it and it moved him, he would write a song to it. So that's the way I'm used to working. But with the band, this time I went home and wrote the lyrics first. Because when you're writing for a band, especially your own band, it prompts you to it's impetus. It makes you feel like, you know, working more. I had stopped writing songs because I had no outlet for them for a long, long time. But now that I have, you know, since when the band started, now we all started writing like crazy because, you know, we can go record it and we can play it, you know.
Sure.
So I came up with all the lyrics. Then I called Waddy. He came over and we went into what you hear, those guitar parts. We just went into those. We didn't talk about it. I just started playing the part I played that you hear on there. And he started playing his part. We just went right into it. And then I started singing the lyrics to that. It worked. And then we put a bridge in it and the way it went.
That's wild. So it was almost like, and I hear this with a lot of good songs, it's kind of like effortless in a sense.
It's sometimes it is effortless. Sometimes it just comes to you, bang, in one fell swoop. And then sometimes you got to agonize over it. You know, there's no one way coming up with material.
Were those lyrics like based on anything like from yourself, or was that just like a parody of like all the bullshit people typically deal with divorce?
It's based on living in Los Angeles.
Yeah, right. I got a lot of that out of that. Yeah.
And when we play that song anywhere in the LA area or something, you know, I said, here's a song we got. It's called Divorced on the 405. And the whole audience goes, they all know exactly.
Not Made That Way. You and Stan Lynch wrote that great slide on there. It's kind of a sad song musically and lyrically when you're talking about someone who's not made that way. I was curious what the backstory was and what makes the hero or the protagonist not made that way.
All right. So that's a song Stanley and I started a long time ago. And we had the chord progressions. I had the chord progressions. And he had the title, Not Made That Way. So I fucked around with it. I couldn't come up with anything for years on that thing. You know, we came up with the original part of it years ago. And then it's laid fallow for a long time because I just I didn't know what to do with it. And then it started to come to me about a statement a man would make that he's not going to cut and run. He's not going to be a douchebag. He's not going to be an asshole. He's going to actually be a stand-up individual for his friends, for his woman, and for his own beliefs without being a pain in the ass about it, you know, without being, you know, a self-righteous schmuck. And I think that I achieved that with most of that lyric. Stanley helped me with the lyric. But after I wrote it, I stopped playing it for a while as well because I didn't really feel that way. I didn't feel I was being honest. And then later, I'd have to say part of it had to do with meeting the woman I'm with now, my girlfriend. Cool. And I realized that the song now had authenticity because I did feel that way about her.
Oh, okay. That's really cool. So that's kind of like bold.
Okay.
No, I mean, that's kind of like honest is probably a better word.
Mm-hmm.
Authentic, sure. You know?
Again, I was just lucky. And again, it was because we had a band that could record all this stuff.
Yeah.
So now it's the same when I was working with Henley. I used to go and work on music because I knew that if I came up with something groovy, we'd go and record it the next day, man.
Yeah.
You know? So that gives you impetus to come up with ideas. And again, it's not work. It's a joy. You know?
Yeah. Best part of making the record?
Every day. Best part is going in there and looking at your buddies and hearing that sound. We have the great Nico Bolas, who engineers for us, who all of us have known since he was 18 or 19 years old. And he is now one of the top audio engineers in the country. And he's our dear pal. So he records us. Just hearing it back, just playing it, working up arrangements. Waddy is great with production ideas and arrangement ideas. Everyone is, because we've all spent our whole lives doing it.
Yeah, right.
And there's very little conversation when we go in. Usually we all know what to do. And whoever wrote the song generally takes the lead in terms of how they want it to go.
Sure.
But we try all kinds of different things. And again, it doesn't require a lot of conversation because we have a telepathy going among all of us, having worked together so many years.
From years of playing each other. Yeah, man. I hope everybody checks out the record. It's called The Immediate. When does it come out?
Immediate Family comes out, I think, August 27th.
Awesome. Very cool. It's a really cool record.
I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. When you become excellent at something, there's usually a price or a sacrifice. What were some of the sacrifices you made or the price that you paid for your success? All to right, whatever well, extent you're comfortable.
the deal with being a musician is, especially when you've been doing it 50 plus years like I have, is it's a roller coaster. It goes up and it goes down. And the fact is, most musicians will tell you this. They think whatever session they did, for instance, that's going to be the last session they ever get called for. And most musicians feel that way.
Yeah.
They're always worried that it's all going to go away. And it does go away. But the thing is, if you hang in there, it comes back in a different form. You know, before I hooked up with Hinley, I had nothing going, you know, nothing at all. I was toast, man. And there was a year and a half there where there was nothing going on. And I couldn't even get an accountant to work with me. No accountant would work with me because I wasn't making enough money. And then I started working with Hinley, and the whole thing changed. Reversal of fortune. Now I'm working with the very top singer-songwriters ever. And Hinley, let me tell you, he's a stunningly brilliant guy.
Yeah, and, sure. Hell of a songwriter.
Astonishingly lucky, although it wasn't just luck. He and I were a good combination. And when I started working with him again, that you know, the clouds parted and the sun came out. And that's what happens. It goes up and down. And I don't think there's any musician that works consistently. And even if you do work consistently, you're always afraid it's all going to go away. That's something that every musician fears.
How did you get hooked up with Hinley?
With Hinley? Well, again, like I said, everybody knew everybody. The Eagles, Jackson, Linda, Peter Asher. We all hung out together. We all knew each other. Now, the Eagles had broken up, and Glenn Frey decided to make a solo album. And in fact, I was on that album, No Fun Allowed. And Glenn Frey's a great guy, hilarious. He was a great guy and just a wonderful cat to be around. Great musician, really knew what he wanted. So it's me and Russ, Bob Glaub, and Hawk Walensky, the keyboard player. We had a ball. We went in there and did a bunch of stuff with Glenn. It was a lot of fun. It was great. But the fact of Glenn having made a solo album, I'm sure drove Don nuts and made him realize he had to do something. You know, there was no Eagles. Here's Glenn coming out with the solo album.
Right.
So Don decided he was going to make a solo album too. And I started hearing that he was calling everyone he knew, all the musicians and writers, to come up to his crib and hang out with him and see if he could find someone that he could collaborate with. So I'd been hearing about this, and I knew the phone was going to ring. I knew he was going to call me. I just knew it. Don't ask me how I knew it, but I knew it. And I knew if I went up there, I'd get the gig. Again, I don't know how I knew. I just had a feeling about it. And sure enough, I went up to his place. And after we hung out for about a couple of hours, I played him some ideas I had. And he says, so you want to work on my solo album with me? And that was it. Off we went.
It changed your life.
Definitely.
And his life.
Yes.
Wow. That's a cool story, man.
We had a great time. I think we were a very creative combination.
Some great songs there, man. Are you kidding?
I agree. Well, you know, with him, come on. He's like, you know, he's a stunning talent, that guy.
But after, like you said, it was a drought for a while, man, that had to be like, fuck yes. That had to feel so good. Yeah. Good, man. That's great. Best decision you ever made?
Best decision I ever made? Yeah.
You're laughing. You're smiling.
I guess hitting on my current girlfriend would have to be comes to mind.
Well, that's a pretty good one.
Mm-hmm. And getting to know her.
Tell me one thing that you're proudest or most grateful for doing or not doing, professionally and personally.
All right. So that's a big ticket there. I'm terribly proud of all the great musicians and songwriters and artists that I've gotten over. I'm terribly proud to have been associated with these brilliant, brilliant people. And I'm constantly in awe that I was able to participate with the likes of, Neil, Billy Joel, Hinley, James, Carol. I mean, they're the best, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, to pick one instance, I'm terribly proud of my association with all these brilliant people. I am terribly, terribly proud to be in the immediate family with my best friends, all of whom are great, great musicians, among the best. And so I'm a lucky guy, you know, in that area. What am I not proud of? Let me see. We played on a Barbie Benton album. I put that as...
That's so funny.
I wouldn't put that as the absolute height of my career.
That's why. Yeah.
Barbie, but again, you did dates. Back in the 70s, you got called to do a date. You went. That's how you got paid, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Not every client, not every gig is like name worthy or, you know, some gigs just exist to pay your bills, man.
Right.
That's the way it is in any business.
Right. But as I told you before, because I got so spoiled from playing with these great musicians, I started to burn out on doing sessions. remember, I was never as did as many dates as Leland or Russ. They did more dates, more record dates than me. Mm-hmm. And I started to realize that as a session guy doing record dates, it's not like Stax Vault or Motown. Mostly 85% of what you're doing is crap.
Yeah.
You know, it's lame shit. And yeah. And I said, I don't want to, this is not why I'm doing this. So I got kicked upstairs and became a producer when I started working with Henley. And then that's when I stopped doing record dates and doing
all right. Did you enjoy that producing?
Yeah, I enjoyed it with Don, certainly, because he was brilliant.
Yeah.
There was other acts after that. When I became a producer, there was other acts that I did not enjoy very much, especially, and I hate to say this, I'm not that patient of a guy. So dealing with young acts that are insecure and don't know what they want and, start copping an attitude or stop, you know, or lose their confidence. I'm not a psychiatrist. I don't have a great bedside manner. And, I think to be a really successful, brilliant producer, you must have that. You must have tremendous patience.
Yeah.
And I don't. So, but, I ended up, most of my production career has been with these really super talented people who I don't need. You don't need to hold their hand or, they're already there,
Well, it's good that you realize that about yourself. So you don't put yourself through endless torture, them.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
All right. This is a tough one. What do you like most about yourself?
What I like most about myself, my friends, my family.
Oh, that's not yourself.
Oh, well, yeah, it is. To me, it is. I don't know what I like. You're going to make me just, that's a bad question for me,
No, it's
I like the fact that people will, that my friends accept me and that I must be a pretty good guy. I think I'm fairly funny. I think I'm fairly smart. I think I play guitar pretty well. Things like that, Again, I can sit here and pat myself on the shoulder. Although I'd be glad to do it. Yeah, I'm fabulous.
Something that or someone you miss from your childhood.
Okay. Someone I miss from my childhood. Well, my parents, my brother, they're all gone.
Sorry about that, man.
A dear friend of mine, a pal, one name comes to mind, a guy named Ricky Philp. Ricky was a guitar player in a band called The Middle Class, and he was a really, really good guitar player. This is back in the day when we were all playing in Greenwich Village. And he was murdered by his college roommate. A wonderful guy.
Shit.
And a wonderful musician. I mean, really, he was better than me. And,
that's heavy, though, man.
So I miss him because he was a great cat.
Wow. Who's had the biggest influence on you musically and also personally?
Well, musically, I've been influenced by all the great artists of the 50s and 60s and 70s. I was influenced musically by the same people the Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin and the Beatles were influenced by. So when I hear people say, oh, they're influenced by the Beatles. Well, I was influenced by this people that influenced the Beatles.
Right.
The same as them. I'm from that generation. So I got to grow up with the first generation of rock and roll, which was astonishing, I'm sorry, repeat the question again, man. I'm getting lost here.
No, it's cool. You're right on it. I said, who's had the biggest influence on your life musically and personally?
Well, when I think about the biggest influences I've had, I think about hearing Little Richard for the first time or Chuck Berry. When I heard Chuck Berry and saw him on TV, I said, wow, that's it. He's playing a guitar. He's rocking and rolling. The lyrics are intelligent and they're not just baby talk. They're intelligent and they're fun. And so he was a huge influence on me and on everybody. But again, that was a big influence on Keith Richards. I was influenced by the same cats that were influencing, like I said, the Rolling Stones and them fellas, because I'm the same age as them. So I grew up listening to the same music, mostly soul music and blues.
Yeah.
I would say. Mm-hmm.
And how about personally, who's influenced you most?
Oh, boy. I'd have to say Jim Keltner would be a major influence on my life, for sure. My mother was a huge influence on my life. She was a very brilliant woman. I don't know. Let me see. Not spiritually, but as a guitar player, Steve Cropper was my hero when I was growing up. And he was the guy I most admired. And I loved the way he played on those Stax Vault records. Loved it. Loved his sound, his approach. And I can still do a mean Steve Cropper impression. On guitar. I learned an awful lot from him. And when I finally met him, I said, so I've been stealing from you for years, man.
So there's a lot of people.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah.
Did you ever see Freddie King live?
I never saw Freddie King live, no.
You have hobbies? Any hobbies or interests outside of music?
I don't have hobbies, but I have interests. Okay. And what I'm interested in is I'm interested in movies. I'm interested in books, literature. I'm interested in politics. I'm interested in sex. I'm interested in religion.
Not many guys admit to being interested in sex. You're like maybe the second. Oddly enough, go figure. I don't know why.
Mm-hmm. Well, to me, those are interesting topics and subjects to discuss. I'm interested in conversation with people that are smarter than me. So I think that about covers it.
Yeah, man. Toughest decision you've ever had to make, Danny, or most difficult thing you've had to do?
Boy, I don't know. Let me think. Well, I don't know about the toughest decision I had to make, but when I was producing Billy Joel, he had brought me out to Long Island. He had set up a studio out in the middle of Shelter Island, which is in the middle of nowhere out there. And he was out there with his touring band. The guys had been playing with him forever. And so I went out there to work with him. And when I got there, his whole band were asleep in the kind of studio lobby. They were all checked out like that. I said, this ain't a good sign. We're starting an album with a new producer and they're asleep. And when I got up, I realized that they're all very good guys and everything like that. I got, you know, but they were too comfortable in their job. See, here's the thing with Sidemen is that this is something I knew instinctively right away, is that they're not there. They're, you know, when I'm playing with James Taylor, they're not there to see me. They're there to see James Taylor. And my job is to help James do his show and entertain the audience. They're not there for me, you know. And once you start thinking you're hot shit and that the audience is coming to see you, you're finished. And that's what happened. These guys were too goddamn comfortable, you know, and it never occurred to them they could be replaced. And they were.
They were.
I told Billy after listening to what they were doing, I said, Billy, this is the tough decision. Can we go on? Let's go into the studio for 2 days. Let me bring in a rhythm section for you. It'll just be me, you and a rhythm section of my choice. And let's see what we come up with. And I also said, let's go to the Hit Factory and not this set up studio that he had on Shelter Island, which is not, sure. You know. So he said, all right, he agreed to do it. And I realized it. And what I said to him was that if this doesn't work out, you can go back doing what you were doing with your band and no problem. Now we're talking about a big album. That's a huge career thing. To get a gig producing Billy Joel or not get it is big. But I knew that's what had to happen. I knew I could do better with my own rhythm section I brought in. And that's what happened after 2 days. We just continued with my guys.
And then he fired his guys.
Well, he didn't fire him. He didn't use them on the record. I wouldn't say
fire
him,
you
know, but he didn't use them on the record. And he kept touring after that.
I give you a lot of credit for that. And it goes to what you said earlier, where you said, I wasn't authentic. I wasn't, sorry, the title of the song. I wasn't able to say I'm not made that way at the time. And now I am. That's pretty cool that you were able, you know, that you were so sincere about it. And you went in there, you went in with authenticity with the guy.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought he owed honesty. You know,
yeah.
He was owed honesty. And you know, that's what I gave him. And I think he recognized also that his band was a little complacent. They had already recorded some stuff and it sounded very ordinary.
Right.
So he was open to the idea of trying it with other people. And, you know, that guy is a double monster, let me tell you.
Yeah.
Everyone knows Billy Joel is talented, but I worked with the guy. And, I mean, he's phenomenal. As a keyboard player, the piano, organ, and as a singer, forget it, man. You know, it's just a joy to play music with that guy.
How did you get that gig?
Well, he was looking for a producer, an East Coast-based producer. At the time, I was living in Connecticut. And he talked to a bunch of different people, I guess. And my manager at the time got me an interview with him, you know. So I went out and met him and talked to them for a while. And then he invited me out to come to his studio in Shelter Island, like I told you, and see what happened. So it grew out of that. I guess my conversation with him, he felt comfortable enough with me to give me a shot.
Man, I give you so much credit for that because it's a huge freaking opportunity. And the average person would have said, oh, I don't want to fuck this up. I don't want to make waves. And you didn't think of that. You thought, well, this is the best thing for him. I'm being hired to do the best thing for him.
Let me
tell him what that best thing is. If he likes it, fine. If he doesn't, fine.
That's right.
Yeah, yes. That's really cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a measure. I mean, to me, I'm not blowing smoke up your ass, but that's a measure of someone, to me, someone's character, you know.
I'm glad you say that, but I was not patting myself on the back about what a great guy I was at the time. I was doing what I thought was honest and real.
Right. That's a measure of a great character. You know, it's not how you treat your boss. How do you treat the waiter? How do you treat, you know, I'm saying you're in a situation where shit might go awry. That's not important to you. You're concerned about the quality of the work you're doing and the quality of the service you're providing. And that's what you should be concerned about. But not a lot of people, most people, I would say probably a lot of people would not handle it that same way.
Well, I don't know how other people would handle it. I just know what I had to do.
Good for you, man. That's a great story. Thank you. That's a really good story. Just a couple more questions, man. Biggest change in your personality over the last 10 or 15 years, and how much of that change has been deliberate and how much is just a part of aging?
Well, you know, I'm not sure if I've gotten more or less obnoxious. I think you'd have to ask my friends that. I think I'm a little more patient than I previously was. You know, I'm a grown up now. And so I act like a grown up. I say grown up things and I do grown up things. And I guess that's the biggest change. And I recommend to all Americans out there, be a grown up. All right.
You know? That's going to be your
quote. Not that hard. You know?
Be a grown up. It's not that hard. I like that. Any final words of wisdom?
Yeah, don't wear cargo shorts and flip-flops to the airport. Come on. You know? Jesus, what's wrong with you? You know, that I think that's a good one, actually.
It is.
I don't know. Yeah, it's hard to say. You know, I don't feel that I'm in a position to be offering sage advice to anyone. I mean, I'm learning myself, you know.
Sure.
I'm a pilgrim, too. So we're all learning at the same time. The obvious stuff. It's just the obvious. The obvious cliches are true. Treat people right. Treat people just have respect for people, especially have respect for working people. Treat them with respect. Don't be a fucking asshole.
Yeah.
That would be rule number one. And it's just basic stuff, man. It's stuff everyone already knows, you know?
Yeah.
You know, what have I learned? I've learned had it reaffirmed what I already knew.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, that's the thing. Remember, I was treated wonderfully. When I moved to Los Angeles, everyone was kind, generous. You know, buddies were loaning me an amp. If I didn't have an amp, Stilsey would loan me an amp. I mean, he didn't know me that well, but there was that kind of a vibe. And Crosby and all those guys, Blue, they were all so generous and good to me that I made it my business to be as generous and as kind to everyone that I encountered and as supportive, I would say, you know. And I've had people come up to me, you know, second engineers come up to me and say, oh, man, you know, you don't remember me, but everyone in the studio treated me like shit except you. You talked to me like I was an actual human being. And I don't even remember doing that, but I'm glad I did. And
that's golden.
And my boys are like that, too. Everybody in my band is like that, too. You know, they treat people right. And
that's
I think that's important.
Yeah, it's very it's everything, man.
I think so.
I don't know if you know this. Do you know Joe?
Joe. Do I know Joe?
Joe Mama. wasn't that like a whole thing in your band? You played in a band called Joe Mama, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Right.
That was a whole thing when I was a kid. People would, was it like a New York thing? People would say, you know, Joe, or, you know, isn't that where that's from?
That's right. Knock, knock. Who's there? Joe
Mama. Joe Mama. Hey man. I really appreciate your time. Thank you very much for being so open. It was very kind of you. And thanks for sharing all the cool stuff you did. I want to tell everybody to check out The Immediate Family. The new album comes out end of August. It's a great record. It's called Immediate Family. They also have a YouTube page. So if you can follow them on YouTube or subscribe to their YouTube page and check out their website, which is The Immediate Family. Also, Danny's on social media if you want to follow him or check him out. Man, thank you for everything. I'm going to just, anything else before I wrap up?
No, just to say my pleasure. Thanks a lot. It's very nice to talk to you. You've been asking me some questions I hadn't thought about, so.
Oh, good, man. Well, hang on one second. We'll wrap up. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this, please share it on your social media channels. We appreciate your support. Thanks very much to Danny Korchmar for, number one, a lifetime of music. Number two, for being such a good, kind person and opening up and sharing here and, you know, spending the time. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice. So choose wisely. Be nice. Go play your guitar and have fun. Till next time. Peace and love, everybody. I am out. Danny, thank you so much for everything, brother.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Everyone Loves Guitar. If you did, make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com/subscribe and subscribe to the audio podcast and to our very active YouTube community. And if you have any comments, please write me at everyonelovesguitar.com/hello. We'll see you on the next episode. Until then, make sure you choose happiness, relax, and have as much fun as possible.